You're listening to the podcast, Send Me. Here with you now is host, Jason Sweet.
What's the count, team leader?
What's the count?
Down!
Keep going!
Hold it.
Try it! Keep going!
Brought to you by SOCOM Athlete. Send Me. Send Me.
Thank you for listening to SOCOM Athlete's podcast, Send Me. This is your host, Jason. Today, we bring to you a true hero, Major Dan Pronk, doctor, tier one special operator, warrior, entrepreneur, author, father, and friend. You, as our listener, most likely know of Dan Pronk from the viral photo that's made its rounds on the internet and on Instagram, in which Dan is holding Taliban drug money, opium, and burning it in the background behind him, and is without a doubt one of the coolest, most intense GWAT pictures out there. After listening to this episode with Dan, you'll see firsthand the man behind that picture is much more. He would lose one of his best friends that day, June 6, 2011, Rowan Robinson. The mission would forever alter the course of his life and give him clarity as a warrior. He would then return to Afghanistan again and again and again. As both a doctor and an SAS operator, Dan would find himself working side by side with America's top special operations forces, from Army Rangers, Navy SEALs, DEA Fast Team, to Air Force PJs in the Helmand River Valley, Afghanistan. The British and Australian Special Air Service, also known as the SAS, are among the most elite counterterrorism special operations units in the world. So without further delay, Dan, my brother, thanks for coming on the podcast. How are you today over there in Australia?
Awesome, man. Yeah, no, look, it's a real privilege, Jason. Thank you for having me.
Man, absolutely. Dan, where are you talking to us from?
So Adelaide, South Australia.
Is it beautiful there or what?
Yeah, look, absolutely. I mean, the whole of Australia, I don't know if you've been, but it's not a bad joint. So, you know, when this COVID thing sorts itself out, come and visit and I'll show you firsthand. But no, nice place, close to the hills, close to the beach, lots of wineries and yeah, beautiful location, good climate.
When's the last time you've been to the States?
Oh, it's been a while. I think, been a long while. We used to get across a little bit over to Fort Bragg to do a bit of stuff there and down your way for the Special Operations Medical Association conference there. But it's probably been almost 10 years. I'm due a trip.
Got to spend a little time in Florida?
Yeah. Don't mind the old flow rider.
Right on, man. Everything's a little bit better in Florida, Dan. Come down and visit us anytime, brother. Dan, what's a day-to-day like for you, man? I mean, now that you're not fighting the good fight in Afghanistan, you're a physician, you're giving back, you're an author. What's that look like for you?
It's good. It's good. You know, the transition out of the military, I'm sure you had the same, was rocky. It was shaky. There was a bit of a loss of identity and a need to find a new tribe and to reestablish myself outside of that role that I held in the military. But once I sort of found my path again, I've moved on. I've got a young family. So I've got three boys who are, the eldest is 13, actually. So not so young anymore, but 13, 10 and 8. So after spending a bunch of time away from them in the early years, there's a lot of reinvestment there and re-engagement and emphasis on really being there as a dad for the missed years and making up for that lost time where possible and with my wife, of course. So there's lots of family time, lots of time spent with the kids at kids' activities. Day-to-day for me I've moved into medical management. So I've done some, when I got out of the army, I did an MBA and then I've done some other medical management qualifications. And so moved into that stream as my full-time job at the moment. And then on the side, have got a few interests. I co-own a couple of small companies, do a bit of writing, a bit of blogging, just trying to make, not so much make sense, but try and pull all the lessons learned out of all those rich experiences that I was lucky enough to have in places like Afghanistan and in my military career. And much like you, Jason, just trying to distill that down and then where possible, you know, feed it into the next generation to try and fire them up and prepare them and help their chances of having the career that they want to have.
Incredible, Dan. There's so many people across the world that are looking for that wisdom and that knowledge from your experiences. And to hear that you're giving that back is amazing. So Dan, where did this all start from you, man? What was baby Dan like?
Yeah, so it was I grew up in my dad was an army helicopter pilot. So I grew up in an army family. So that was familiar from the earliest ages, had an elder brother, still do. So I've got an older brother, Ben, who went into the military straight out of school. And he was always in that mold. That was Ben, you know, every photo of him as a kid, he had this little toy M16 that he'd cart around. And so the writing was on the wall early. I went in a different pathway. So we moved around a lot as kids, and I was a bit of a shy, reserved kid. I mentioned it before, a bit of a little fat kid, didn't excel at anything, but got by, didn't have a big group of friends. You know, every couple of years we'd move on. So got through my schooling. That was a bit of a bumpy ride, didn't do exceptionally well, but when I got out of school, I had a keen interest in triathlon by that time. So I'd gotten quite sporty in my later years of school. Didn't do fantastically academically, but did well enough to get into uni. So drifted through school, got out the other end, chased the triathlon dream for 4 or 5 years and gave that a good nudge, but was never going to be the triathlete that I aspired to be. And that was pretty clear. Had done some uni and started to hit my stride at uni. So I did an exercise science degree. And for the first time, the content of that just resonated with me. It made sense. I was keen on my triathlon. It was relevant. And so I really engaged there and did well at uni, well enough to get myself into medicine. And when my triathlon aspirations sort of fell through, the started looking towards med school, did the entrance exam there at around the same time, had applied for the army, and the two came together. So the army, I think it's the same in the States, the army here's got the military have got scholarship schemes to pump you through med school. And so you sign up, you go and do your med school, and then you pay back return of service. And so that was kind of the pathway that eventually led me into the military role that I had.
And Dan, as far as medicine, was that something that attracted you when you were younger, or was that something that you just kind of felt led to go into? What was the drive for that?
Look, it had never occurred to me to become a doctor until about a week before I applied for the entrance exam, to be honest. It was never on the radar. There's no doctors in our family. It was never an aspiration. It just kind of happened. I almost fell backwards into it. So it was at a bit of a loose end when the triathlon thing fell through. I was 100% focused on that and convinced that I was going to make a career of that. And when that came apart, I was a little bit lost and directionless. And I had an exercise science degree at that point, and which in itself didn't open a lot of doors. That was the very late 90s. And there wasn't a lot of roles, and certainly none I really wanted to do with that qualification. And so I started looking at what was next, and it was either going to be physiotherapy or medicine. And so I threw my hat in the ring for medicine, did the entrance exam and got a good enough score. And so it was only at that point that I first thought, you know, shit, I could become a doctor. And I did.
You became a doctor, and then you joined the army. Is that correct?
No, it was the other way around. So I joined the army at the start of my medical schooling. So I applied for the army, and they had that scholarship scheme. So I signed up, I was full-time army, but I went off to uni like any other civilian student. So basically,
okay,
the army paid me. I was a full-time army member, but I didn't have any military commitment. I just went to uni, got my quals, did a couple of years as a junior doctor in civilian hospitals. And so I was basically 6 years into my service on paper without having ever really pulled on a uniform. So, and then I, after that, went into, posted to units and started chucking on the uniform and doing the real army job, if you like.
Right. So I guess the better question would be, the army gave you this scholarship to forgo medical training. What did you do after that with the scholarship? Because you owe the army after that, right? They gave you that formal education, and now you got to go use it. So where did Dan Pronk decide to take this education to?
Well, yes, I mean, that's part of the deal. So I signed on for what was an 11-year contract. The first six was my 4 years of medical schooling as postgraduate medicine here in Australia, and then 2 years as a junior doctor in civilian hospitals doing my internship and first year residency. And then I owed 5 years of service. So that was the contract. And the first year of that, any military doctor coming into our system, you've got your medical qualification, you've got a couple of years of experience, but then you need to learn how to apply all of that in the military context. So the first year was made up of a whole bunch of courses to learn to be an army doctor. So you go off and you do a aeromedical evacuation course, you do early management, severe trauma, the pre-hospital kind of PHTLS, I think they call it over in the States, the pre-hospital trauma life support, and then a variety of logistics courses. You do your basic officer training, you do a medical officer intro course. And so it was a really, you know, fun year getting tooled up to learn to use your medical skills in the military context. And then at the end of that, you become deployable as a army doc. And so at that point, I started posting to units. And so I'd be the doctor for units and pretty quickly moved into infantry. And from early in my med schooling, I'd had a look at special operations. So my elder brother had gone into the army. He had gone infantry, done some time as an infantry platoon commander, and then done special air service regiment selection, and so he'd gone across to the SAS, and so I'd seen what that looked like, and that was where I wanted to head, and so I tried to streamline myself to get on a selection course myself.
Incredible. And Dan, I took my notes here, and I have written down that in your second year of medical school, which was 2008, is when you found out about this and essentially decided that you were going to go into the SAS based on your brother.
Yeah, so that was actually 2002 was
2002?
My second year. Yeah, it was 2008 when I finally got the chance to go on the course.
I'm a terrible note taker, Dan.
No, that's quite fine, man. It's a convoluted sort of a history, and there was a long gap between when I saw what went on at the SAS regiment, and that was just I'd gone and visited my brother before, so that was obviously shortly after September 11 in 01, and everyone was there was the early push into Afghanistan, and my brother was tooling up to go with the second push from the Australian Special Operations contingent in early 02. And I'd gone to visit him just basically before he cleared out to say hi. And it was at that point that I saw what that unit did and met some of the blokes, and it was kind of a light bulb moment for me. It was just I'd been a little directionless after the triathlon thing fell through. Medicine was very mentally stimulating, of course, but it kind of didn't scratch that itch that I wanted a physical challenge somewhere in there. And then when I saw that this unit existed and the opportunity to use my medical skills in an operation that was going to, in an organization that was going to be very physical, very purpose-driven, it just seemed to fit. It resonated. And so, yeah, in 02, I decided I wanted to be a part of that. And I had to wait till 2008 to get on the selection course.
And Dan, in the United States military and special operations, we don't have a physician, a doctor who carries a weapon and goes out and does operations or direct action. We have some special operations doctors, but they're more in a supportive role. So the Australian military actually takes doctors and then allows them to go and operate in the field. How does that work?
It was on an individual basis. And just actually to counter that statement, Jason, if I might, I have actually met a couple of your physicians that have gone out at the pointy ends, and I won't mention his name, but one particular ranger doctor, very impressive bloke, had some amazing experiences, but that might be an offline conversation. You might know the guy. But it was an individual sort of basis, and there was a couple of doctors that trod the path before me in Afghanistan and just proved that concept and established the medical officer role as an outside the wire role on an individual basis. If you had the right doctor who had that, who was keen to do that and who was tactically appropriate and just fit, then the task group was willing to push that capability forward. But by that same token, we had, you know, very, very well-trained combat medics that could do the exact same role fundamentally. I mean, pre-hospital, and you know this, the pre-hospital management of gunshot and blast, it's fairly down and dirty, rudimentary. It's not high-level cerebral medicine. It is just stopping bleeding and decompressing chests and basic airways. And so you don't need a medical degree to do it, but certainly military was happy to have me out in the field. I was happy to go, and so it came together nicely.
Well, Dan, you're quite humble and quite eloquent. And for our listeners out there, what Dan is essentially saying, for lack of better words, is that this was a unique position that takes a special individual in order to create. So Dan, you ended up being a physician that decided to go into SASR selection. Can you tell us about that selection? Because our listeners out there, most of them are training to be a special operator. So what was it like doing that for you?
It was probably to this date one of the best experiences of my life. I mean, it's just such a massive thing, and I know that you know this. It's hard to convey it in words to those who haven't, and for the listeners, I mean, my overwhelming sentiment is go for it. It's an achievable goal. It's a daunting goal, but I think it is more daunting because of all the stigma and all that sort of aura that surrounds it, and this misconception that special operators are these superhuman beings that are genetically gifted and the lucky few. It's just not the case. It's a bunch of, well, I worked with some fairly extraordinary people, I've got to say, but for the most part, it's ordinary people that set good habits, set this lofty goal and mentally focus and prepare themselves and have the nerve to step up, ignore the criticism. And so, look, for me, it had been that goal for 6+ years. And so I was really emotionally and mentally invested into it. I had been training year in, year out for that period of time. I mean, you don't need to. That was just my circumstance, because I was at medical school and then as a junior doc, I just simply logistically couldn't get on the course for that period of time. So by the time I stepped up for the course, I had invested so much in it, and psychologically I had prepared myself to the point where I was convinced I wasn't going to withdraw myself. I knew that I might get injured, I might get to the end of the course and not be suitable. I knew they might grab me and kick me off at some point during the course. I'd accepted all of that, but I knew in my mind that I wasn't going to quit. And so then it's a matter of, I mean, the selection course, our SAS course, they're all fundamentally the same in my experience with the varying selection courses across military and police special units in Australia, and then getting a bit of a look into some of the international courses, some of the courses for the US elements. They're all fundamentally the same principle. It's just designed to incrementally stress the candidates and just test them psychologically. So break them down physically to reveal their psychological core, and just see if they can keep pushing when they're food deprived, sleep deprived, when they're constantly given objectives they can't meet and they fail, and then they have to reset and go again. And so it all just ratchets up over a 3-week period on the SAS course. And then, you know, if you're left standing at the end, they'll pick and choose whether you were suitable and showed the attributes to be going on for further training with the unit. So, you know, it can be terrible at the time, absolutely, but it's a simple course, if you like. There's no trick to it. There's no hidden agenda, but it's very difficult to complete it. But with hindsight, I think it certainly massively expanded my own perception of what I was capable of. It pushed me exponentially past the physical and psychological limits that I thought I had. And I think that's another thing in a modern day, certainly middle-class existence, we don't get that opportunity to push past our boundaries. And indeed, we don't need to. We can live these comfortable lives. But certainly there's plenty of people out there, and I imagine your listener base are ones that feel that there must be something more and want to challenge themselves. And it's just such a perfect forum to do just that. And then it leads to an environment, if you're successful, whereby you can become part of a unit that you can then extend that further and do the job that you've been training to do.
Well said, Dan. How does it compare to U.S. Special Operations selection in a general regards of log PT, cold water exposure, long ruck marches, a 1.5 mile run test or a three mile run test, 6 mile ruck marches, just kind of all of that typical distances, challenges? How does that look for SASR selection?
I think it's very similar to something along the lines of maybe the Delta selection course or the Team 6 course. It's based on the British SAS selection course. So I guess they were the original unit that most of these elements were based on. And so certainly the Australian SAS is closely molded off the British SAS and then those tier one sort of SMU type units, if we're still using that terminology in the States, it's all in that same realm. And so those criteria are very consistent across the courses as I understand it. So there's certain set criteria you've got to meet physically, you know, a minimum amount of push-ups, sit-ups, chin-ups at the very start, a 2.4 kilometer run, so 1.5 miles of just clean skin in a certain time. You've got your 3.2 kilometer, your couple of mile running with your webbing and your rifle, and then there's a 20 kilometer pack march that needs to be done within a set time. So there are those set criteria that you need to hit the mark or you don't move past, but they're very achievable. You have to be fit to do it, but it's not superhuman. It's not Olympic standards. You know, just they need an operator that can lug a pack and can run when required. And then over the course of the selection period, you get that frequent PT sessions to just sort of grunge down short, sharp. But so it's very consistent, as I understand it, to most of the other selection processes for the other like units internationally.
This is tier one operations, so this is no easy selection. Dan, what was the factor that you had in your mind that got you through selection? What was the drive for you?
I think it was probably instilled in both my brother and I from a very early age. Our dad was very much of the opinion that if other people could do it, you can do it too, that everything's achievable. And he gave us that mindset to be able to just approach lofty challenges with that confidence and also that goal setting ability. So for me, I went into the course feeling very well prepared. I knew I had done physically the hard yards. I was emotionally invested and psychologically invested in the outcome, but I was not overly confident to the point where it was a foregone conclusion. I knew that the outcome could be a negative one. I knew that through no fault of my own, I could do my best on the course, get to the end and just be not what the unit was looking for. But I was resigned to the fact that this was something that I didn't want to die wondering. And so, I knew I might come out the other end and not be picked up, and that would have been very tough. I knew I might have been removed from the course. That might have been very, very tough to deal with at the time. But my mindset, and it was at the time and still very much is, don't die wondering. All that kind of cliched stuff, you only get one go at this. And if there's something you really want to do, get out and give it a crack. If you fail, then at least when you look back, you've given it a chance. And it was the same with the triathlon. You know, I'm well past a window where I can be an elite sports person. That window shut a decade ago, probably more. But I look back and I think, you know what, I gave it a go. I didn't achieve what I wanted to, not by a long shot, but I won't die wondering. And it was the same. So it was my mindset going into the SAS selection course. I was with the Army. I knew that any angle that I looked at it from, I was going to have a really interesting career. And I had just hoped to push that into the special operations realm. And so I stepped up and gave it a go. And, you know, fortunately, it played out well. And I had a really privileged run with special operations. But any way you look at it, I stepped up and had a go. And this is a conversation I have often with people who are looking towards special operations or people who might have stepped up and not gotten through. I think that's huge. And I mean, I really take my hat off to the ones who step up, get to the end, don't get picked up, and then come back and do it again. To me, that is just unbelievable, because there's a certain naivety going into it for the first time. You don't know just how much it's going to hurt and just how difficult it is going to be at the end. But if you know that and you go back, that's amazing. You should have a spot in special operations, in my opinion.
Well said, Dan. That's resiliency and toughness. Yep. Just keep coming back. You got a mission, yep, and you're going to get it done, no doubt. So yep. Dan, can you tell us about the uniqueness of the SAS? What's their mission set and what separates them from other special operations around the globe?
Look, I think I don't know that they're separate. I think there's, and having had the opportunity to work with a bunch of the different elements of US special operations and the British special ops and other international groups, I think it's all the same mindset. It's all the similar mission profiles. Typically and historically, the SAS Reg Militia had a predominantly long range reconnaissance mission. And in Afghanistan, that's certainly how they started off. And then that morphed towards the end of the conflict there to be more of a targeting type manned, the kill capture type missions. But the actual, in terms of uniqueness, that unit sits on a spectrum in the Australian military, as is the case with all other militaries. And it has significant overlap. The other special operations unit, the 2nd Commando Regiment, is one of our other premier special forces units here in Australia. And so there's some overlap in their capability and mission profile. And then there's just some unique sort of mandates that each of the units hold. So I don't think it sits alone as a unique unit. It sits on a spectrum, and it certainly sits at the upper end of the spectrum for certain capabilities. But and when you think about it, all the people from that unit come from a regular army unit or a regular military unit. So it's certainly not sitting there by itself, unique with people purpose built for that unit. It's just a continuum of people who have progressed through regular military, wanted something more, trained towards it, and gotten into that. So it's almost an extension of, is the way I look at it, rather than a unique entity.
And Dan, the counterterrorism component is a large part of the SAS, and you found yourself in Afghanistan not once, but four times. Can you tell us about how you got placed in this fight, the global war on terrorism, and a little bit about your experience getting into that?
Yeah, so Australia, as most listeners will probably know, had an involvement from the very early days. So pushed some special ops forward at the end of 2001, pretty soon after the Twin Towers fell. And with that very early push that was led by the US there was Australian contingent. And then that continued on in bits and pieces over the years. There was some sort of drawdown and then reinforcement. And then towards the late 2000s, leading into 7, 8, 9, 10 and onwards, the Australian commitment was at our full force. And that was when I was starting to come into special operations. So I'd done the selection course in 2008, and then had a brief stint where I got called back to my parent unit, and I deployed to East Timor with the infantry battalion that I'd come from. And so I did a tour there and then came back, went across to special operations, and then deployed first to Afghanistan in 2009. So our task group over there in Tarinkout in southern Afghanistan, there, Uruzgan province, had a medical officer position. And so I was lucky enough to fill that a number of times. And so that put me across there. And then, like I was talking about before, it just the stars aligned, and I had a command chain that was willing to allow me to project forward, and I was keen to do so. And so it fell into that pattern over those tours, whereby I was able to get out and do some on the ground job.
And Dan, can you tell us about any of your missions in Afghanistan? I know that you did a lot, over 100 combat missions, and I know that some of them are probably challenging for you to talk about, but is there one maybe in particular that you could share with us?
Yeah, absolutely. So there was a couple actually on my second tour of Afghanistan, three, in fact, where I think were pivotal to me professionally and personally. And so I'd gone through my first tour of Afghanistan, got some great experience. Everything was new and shiny, and I was keen and probably a bit naive, to be honest. And as fate would have it, we didn't sustain any fatalities on that tour. And so I'd come back from that with a bit of a false sense of security. It was kind of all care, no responsibility. We had a few blokes hit, but not seriously hit. There was lots and lots of near misses. And I guess at the end of that, I had this maybe a misconception about what war looked like. And it was just a whole bunch of fun, to be honest. It was just a great experience. And I had, invested so much in being there. It was the realization of this dream, getting to special operations, and then it was deploying with them. So that was the pinnacle. It everything lined up for me to get into those units and get overseas and do my job outside the wire. And so it was all this, just this fantastic realization of my professional aspirations that had been a long time coming. And so I'd come home from that trip, as with most of us, was busting to get back over there, and then got back over on my second tour. And a few months into that tour, we were starting to do some fairly heavy jobs down into Helmand province. And you know all about Helmand with your experience as a PJ over there. So lots of very kinetic jobs, lots of gunfighting, lots of casualties. And it was on that tour that within a space of a few months, we had three fatalities in our task group and three blokes, all of which I knew, all of which I responded to in the field and none of which I could save. And so I guess that period of time was one where the reality of what we were doing really hit home. That bulletproof naivety went away, and I realized we're playing for keeps here. This is real. These people are getting, they're getting killed, and if they can get killed, I can certainly get killed. I mean, soldiers certainly of a caliber far higher than myself. This wasn't sort of good soldier, bad soldier. This was, you started to see that this was just, luck or fate or whatever you want to call it, was at play here. And whether a bullet skimmed past your head or went through your head, when you think about that, bullet's been shot at 400 meters perhaps, and it's the difference between a breath of wind or hitting a leaf on the way, or whether you turn your head at one time or another. So that period was a real eye-opener for me, and really completely changed the way I viewed my role, the way that I viewed, well, my life, to be honest. It was a pivotal point. But in terms of a specific mission, I guess and I know that photo we've spoken about it, you posted it, I saw it, that photo of burning drugs and money, that day is probably as good as any to talk to. And so we were working with the DEA at that point. So one of the DEA FAST teams was we hooked up with them, and we were doing some counter-narcotic jobs that day. And so we were hitting two targets. The first target we hit was a trade of about a ton of raw opium from memory. And so we rolled into that target and unopposed, got into the village, got the drugs, bunch of ID componentry and blew all of it. And as we were in that village, we started to get a lot of harassing fire and that intensified. We had a second target to go to, which was about 10 minutes time of flight away. And so the plan was to just complete that first job, extract, insert on the second target, clear that. That was a village, and that was the village that had the heroin that is in that photo that we're destroying. So on extraction from that, and we'd inserted a blocking force into that second target, so we already had some of our guys on that target, and we knew before we extracted from the first target that they were in heavy contact. So we knew there was a decent gunfight going on there, and there was a pressure to get to the second target, clear it, and then get out of there before we took a casualty. So we as we were extracting from that first target, our helicopter actually overflew its extraction landing zone. There was a relatively safe bit of dead ground there, and for whatever reason, it overflew that and landed out in the open. And there was a handful of enemy in a little cemetery just up the hill. And so the helicopter starts getting shot up. We're running to this bird. We'd come out from the village, running up the hill, trying to get on this helicopter. Everyone's shooting and firing 40 mil. The door gunner on the bird sliding up. And so everything got pretty exciting there, and we got our guys on the helicopter, and one of the guys, actually a DEA guy, got hit on extraction. So he took a gunshot wound in the high thigh. And so they chucked him on the helicopter. I bailed in after him, and the bird takes off. Lots of noise, lots of gunfire going on. We've got this guy bleeding on the deck there. We've got 10 minutes to fly to the next target. And so it was sort of, you know, this was the theme of that rotation. There was a lot going on, but this particular day, so thankfully he seemed pretty good. You know, I needed to make a decision fairly quickly whether we needed to go to a surgical facility and drop him off as a priority or get to the second target. And he looked okay. He looked pretty stable. I could see the entrance wound and it wasn't bleeding arterially. Couldn't find the exit and was worried it might be in his gut, but he was not deteriorating in the few minutes that I had to assess him. So we made the decision to insert on the second target and leave him on the bird. And he went back and thankfully did really well. It was just a neat through and through, and he recovered really quickly. On the second target, rolled in, lots of gunfire from our blocking force, but we moved through the marketplace pretty quickly, found a bunch of weapons, found the heroin, destroyed all of that and a stack of that Taliban drug money. And that's where that photo comes from. So, I mean, that at that point, everything on that job was going well. The blocking forces were in fairly sort of heavy contact, but were suppressing the enemy. We had done our job. We'd cleared the village and we were moving to extract. And so about an hour after, or less than, maybe 30 minutes after that photo was taken, we get the call over the radio that we've had another casualty. And so this guy was a gunshot wound to the neck, was what came over the comms. And so me and another operator sort of left where we were meant to extract from and basically ran back through the village about a kilometre back up to where this guy was. And he was in an overwatch position, so up on a feature, shooting down into the green belt on the other side where the enemy was sort of held up. So we recovered that guy from the fighting pit that he was in, moved him down. There was a US Department of State Department Huey that was hovering in the battle space in support of the DEA. And it was a sort of CSAR bird, if you like. It had a minigun, but it was also fitted with a stretcher, and it had a US contractor who was an X-18 Delta. And so really good capability right there. And bought that bird in, got our guy on there and worked on him on the way back, made best speed to the nearest surgical facility. And sadly, he couldn't be salvaged. So he was one of our young engineers, a bloke by the name of Rowan Robinson, and we lost Rowan on that day. And so that was June the 6th, 2011. And in May 23rd, actually, just a few weeks prior, these are dates that are really etched into my mind. We'd lost another bloke that I'd responded to in the field. We were on our second day of a mission. There'd been really heavy sort of gunfighting there. And he'd moved a team forward to try and clear some enemy machine gun positions, a four-man team. And he struck an IED and we moved forward and couldn't salvage him. And so there'd been that on the 23rd of May. 6th of June, we lost Rowan. And then 4th of July, we lost another brilliant human being and an incredible operator by the name of Todd Langley. And so that period of time was just where everything changed for me professionally and personally, and was a period of time that I took a long while to process and make sense of. And certainly there was a lot of memories that came out of those three incidents that have stuck with me. But yeah, I think just to bring that back to the, because I know that photo floats around and it's kind of done the rounds on the internet, and I guess people look at it and see what they see. And I suppose it's a snapshot in time. It's an interesting photo, but what I see is what happened 30 minutes later. You know, I don't see it from the same angle as others. I see that as representing, you know, the just within an hour of when we lost one of our blokes. And so, yeah, there was lots of experiences like that, lots of rich experiences, good and bad. But that was a really pivotal turning point in my life and really made me rethink how I did my job professionally, but also how I conducted myself personally. It was a real sort of fulcrum, if you like.
Incredible, Dan. Thank you so much for sharing that story. Really appreciate that. Dan, you went back again and then again to Afghanistan. What happened after that in your life? Where did you go after all the war fighting?
Yeah, so I guess I'd gotten back from that tour, and I was a bit frazzled. Most of the task group were. I was struggling to make sense of a lot of it, and certainly lent on the army psychologists a bit and started to process it. And for me, part of processing that at the time, I thought, was getting back over there and doing the job again. It was a strange, I guess, paradox, if you like. It was this fairly significant trauma that I'd experienced on that rotation, but part of what I felt would heal me was going back. And I'm not sure if that was correct or not. I don't know. But yeah, I did another two tours after that and had a few other similar experiences that kind of added to it all. But then in 2014, so 2013, my wife and I had our third son. So in among all that period of time, that 5 years when I was doing a bunch overseas and when I was with Special Operations, we'd had two children. And then a third came along in the middle of 2013, which actually on the exact same date, so 6th of June, so the same date that we lost Ron. So that's a really significant date for me as I move forward. It's a bittersweet. It was the birth of our third son, but that day that we lost Rowan. And so at that point, my wife was ready for me to leave the army. Three young kids, it was time to spend more time at home. And also the reality of the risk that I was putting myself in, if you like, was starting to really register. It hadn't prior, but certainly after that 2011 trip, it did. And the selfishness, if you like. So it wasn't just me. If I got killed, then so be it. But I was going to leave behind a wife and three young kids, as sadly, you know, many of our colleagues did. And I was starting to see the human side of that, the devastation of the families of the blokes we lost, the wives, the kids, the parents. And so it was all starting, that was all starting to factor in. I was, with hindsight, probably pretty burned out and fried. It had been a busy 5 years, and I hadn't spent any time trying to process anything that had happened. I'd just pack it away and get on with the next job, as most of us did. And so, yeah, for a variety of reasons, it was time to get out. And so I did. I discharged shortly after the birth of our third son. I put my discharge in and got out at the start of 2014, and then started to try and work out what was next. Like the triathlon thing, I hadn't thought much past my goal. And so I kind of got caught out a little bit when I popped out and tried to do this civilian thing. It was harder than I thought.
Well, you're doing a great job, Dan. You're making the world a better place. So being a dad now and an author too, tell us about that.
Yeah, so I actually had, I wrote a book. And so part of when I got back from 2011, the psychologist, I was trying to make sense of all those events. And the psychologist said, well, have you thought about, you know, writing it down? And with hindsight, I've looked up the literature. There's some really good literature talking about expressive writing as a means of processing, you know, traumatic events. And so she put this idea in my head, and I thought, that's a good one. I'll go away and do that. And so I found that really cathartic. I found the sitting and just writing for myself, not for anyone in particular, but just for myself to capture all the detail of those events, get it straight in my head, get it on paper, was a really great way of starting to make sense of what had happened and process it. And so, long story short, that led to a love of writing. And I ended up writing a full book. Like, it was meant to just be a couple of little scribbles about those events, but I enjoyed the process, found it very cathartic. It was a good activity for me. And so I wrote 130,000 words, just capturing it was sort of basically an autobiography to that date. And so I put this book together. I sent it off when it was done in 2014. So it took some years. I kind of came and went from it. I was busy with army work and it sat on the hard drive of the computer. Finished it in 2014, sent it off to Special Operations saying, hey, you know, what do you reckon? And they said, yep, good read, but absolutely no way you're ever publishing this. And if you try, we'll drag you through the courts. And which was fair enough. It was never written for anyone to read, and it had a lot of detail in there that was really pretty gritty sort of detail of casualties and lots of stuff that wasn't appropriate, operational security stuff. And so anyway, that was where the love of writing came from. And as I went along, got out of the army, started to try and work out how I can use some of these experiences, how I can move forward positively, and started to engage a little bit on social media, engage with police groups, military groups, trying to get some of my lessons learned across to them so that hopefully something positive could come out of some of these negative situations. I started to get into the Instagram side of things and build a little bit of a profile there and engage with an audience there. And then that average 70 kilo dickhead, that book project kind of fell out of all of that. It was just, how can I just capture a few of these lessons learned in print, take some of the stuff from that original manuscript and distill it down and in a non-offensive way and get that out there. And so there was some of the stuff from that original book in a really watered down version, and then other bits and pieces as I processed my own thought processes and made sense of it that I just wanted to capture. And so that led to that. And then more recently, so my brother, I mentioned before, he ended up the commanding officer of the SAS regiment and then has gotten out in the last few years and moved on to business interests. And he's in a business partnership with another ex-SAS guy. And the three of us have gotten together and just recently written a book around resilience. And so I've become fascinated in the last 5 years about this concept of resilience and looking at what made us so resilient when we were within the units we were in, and you can sustain all this trauma and keep going, keep functioning at the highest level. And then it seemed, certainly for myself, it wasn't until I got out of that environment and was in a much safer civilian environment that I started to actually have a few struggles with my mental health. And I've seen this repeat over and over with mates of mine that have discharged. They seem to go fine while they're in the unit, sustaining all the trauma. It's manageable, and then they get out and they have a bit of a period of struggle. And so that kind of drove this interest in resilience and really looking at what it is as a construct. And out of that, we've built this somewhat novel model of resilience that we call the resilient shield, which just breaks resilience down into layers. So these various layers of the shield, and just looking at them independently, and then at a very granular level, looking at the evidence base behind what resilience is, what we know contributes to resilience, and then how you can go about your day-to-day life to make yourself more resilient, and mapping that against something like the SAS regiment or the Second Commando regiment, or insert, high-performing team here. And when you're a part of that, you're able to be individually and as a group very resilient, and looking at the factors that make that up, and then how can you recreate that in other environments. And so that's been our most recent book project. That's due out in August this year, actually, so that'll get published. So yeah, so the writing thing has become a real passion of mine in the last 4 or 5 years.
Awesome, Dan. There's a book that I read my junior year of college by David Epstein called The Sports Gene that I recommend. You might like it. Catharsis, you brought that word up. And we had a guest on 2 podcast episodes ago, Roger Sparks, and he spoke of his company now, Cathartic Inc., and how it is cathartic for him to tattoo, and then obviously to mentor the up and coming generation of special operators. So Dan, thank you so much for sharing that. It's absolutely incredible. And Dan, as you continue to move forward as an author, where do you see yourself going now? Do you see yourself moving forward more with the TACMED medical protocols and your role with them, or being an author, or just everything altogether, doing research? What's next for Dan Pronk?
Yeah, a combination of all of the above. So things are pretty busy. And with that same ethos of don't die wondering, I've kind of charged headlong into a couple of business interests. I was lucky enough to be able to become a part of TACMED, so TACMED Australia, which was a company that was founded by a good friend of mine and a ex-special operations medic, Jeremy Holder, who actually won a medal for gallantry for his actions in combat in Afghanistan when they were in a pretty pretty dire situation, and Jez exposed himself significantly to enemy fire to get to wounded casualties. So, you know, that's the caliber of bloke who founded this company. And when I got out of the army, I was I'd started a small tactical medical training company and ended up morphing that into TACMED Australia. And so, and then there's another ex special operations medic by the name of Adam Cantrick, who also co-owns the company. So that's been a real privilege to be a part of that. And it's a company that Jeremy started and kind of grew as a small company working out of his garage, you know, the standard kind of entrepreneurial startup story. And it's really gained momentum in the last 4 or 5 years. I think we've got about 20 full-time employees and starting to really grow. And so it's been a fantastic side project, and it's starting to reach the point where I'm able to move across and do a bit more with TACMED. So that's a great piece of the my life now and a real interest. And from a work perspective, I'm currently doing a medical management role, but I'll be transitioning out of that shortly to move more into doing the TACMED work and probably go back and do a bit of emergency department work and get back into that. And then I've got some fairly disparate business interests. I've founded a company actually with another good friend of mine who's a police officer up in Queensland in Australia. And we've made it's a thing called Coffee Cannon. And so this was an idea that I had many years ago that we've operationalized, and basically a magazine fed bolt action K-cup coffee pod dispenser. And so we've gotten that to the stage of near production. So we've got the molds made. And so, I mean, there's all these kind of interests where I'm trying to pull together my what makes me tick, what excites me. Some of my background in military has fueled this, and then some of my background from doing an MBA and entrepreneurial interests. I find the entrepreneurial type stuff strangely seems to replace some of the excitement I got from special operations, which I know they're very different beasts, but when you look at them in essence, there's risk involved. Your small agile teams that need to move fast and pivot and respond to the situation, and so it's, I think, from a mentality perspective, if you like, the entrepreneurs are the spec ops of the business world, and so that excites me, and I enjoy that. So there's those projects. There's certainly we've got the Resilient Shield book coming out soon, and we founded a company around that. We've got a research grant, a government research grant, to do some research. So we formulated a survey, and we're gathering data on people's resilience profiles, and we're looking at scientifically validating our resilience model. And so that's very exciting to me, and that's something that the Resilient Shield team, myself, my brother Ben, and Tim, the third ex-SAS bloke who's in on that, are very passionate about. So there's a lot of work we've been doing with workshops, presentations, working with government organisations, private entities, businesses, militaries, to just get that across, and just to try and demystify this construct of resilience and give people granular level tools to be able to build resilience. And so that's a real passion. So there'll be a lot more of that moving forward. And I've got another couple of book projects in the pipeline. I've been working away at one on psychological preparation for special unit selection. And so that's something that I'm hugely passionate about, as of course you are. And you know, we need to talk further about that. I'm keen to pick your brain on that, Jason. But so that's another project that I'm hoping to get to fruition in the near future. And just looking at, I think a lot of candidates focus really strongly on the physical side of special unit selection and preparation, which you must, of course. But right. I think there's a massive missed opportunity to psychologically prepare yourself and build mental resilience for the course. And when you look at the vast majority of people who wash out of special forces courses, it is not because they're physically exhausted or broken or couldn't meet the physical capability. It's a psychological thing. You get people that bail out on day two, well before they are physically, broken or incapable of the what's required of them. it's psychological. And I see that as being a real opportunity for people to better psychologically prepare. And if you can frame the course well, if you have a good understanding of complexity theory, and a thing called complex adaptive systems is a great structure to look at a selection course. If you look at things like conflict management styles, understand your own personality a bit better and how you might interact, have a better understanding of what they're trying to achieve in selection, what they're looking at it from a unit perspective. I mean, it's a job interview and it's you're playing a role and the DS are playing a role, but I suspect that a lot of people don't register this, or it gets lost once they start to get on the course and get a bit stressed and sleep deprived, food deprived. They lose sight of all of this and then they pull themselves off the course and immediately regret it. So yeah, I think there's a real opportunity to balance the physical and psychological preparation and better prepare people for the courses.
That's big time wisdom there, Dan. And I know that I would love to pick up a copy of your book, particularly listen to it. How do we get a copy of your book, Dan, for our listeners out there?
Yeah, so the average 70 kilo dickhead is available on Amazon. You can just hop on Amazon and have a look for that. And then the Resilient Shield will, so it's not yet out. It'll be available for pre-order in April. I think it's coming online. But certainly I'm very active on Instagram, just as Dan Pronk, and I'll keep everyone updated on that. And so average 70 kilos there, and it's a bit of an intro and a bit of a kind of just a bit of an indicator of how I see the world and a couple of my lessons learned. The manuscript, that original one that I did, which I titled Voodoo Medicine, it's still sitting on my desk, and I've actually dusted it off with a view to give it a good edit and with a goal of getting it published. So hopefully in the coming years, I'll get that out as well. But for now, the average 70 kilos there on Amazon, I'll keep everyone up to speed on my Instagram when Resilient Shield is coming out.
All right, Dan. Sounds good. Thank you again so much for coming on the podcast and dropping this wisdom on us, Dan. It was an absolutely phenomenal time, brother.
Jason, it's been a real privilege, man. I greatly appreciate this opportunity. And to all your listeners out there, I mentioned it before, but if you're looking at this special unit thing, and if it's something that's nagging away at you in the back of your mind, my advice is get on and give it a go. You know, it's an achievable goal. It's a hard goal, but it's well achievable for average people. I'm a profoundly average person, and I managed to have a really unbelievable experience with special operations. And it was just plain and simple, setting that goal, chipping away at it, backing myself, not concerning myself too much with the critics, having that self-belief without being overconfident, and stepping up and having a go. So get into it. Don't find yourself looking back at my age, your mid-40s, as an old man with a bulging spinal disc and wondering if you could have done it. Get out and give it a go.
Well, there you have it from Mr. Dan Pronk, father, warrior, doctor, author, entrepreneur, a man of many hats, and an incredible human being. Thank you, Dan, for coming on the podcast with us tonight.
Pleasure, Jason. Cheers for your time, man.
Thanks for listening to SOCOM Athletes Podcast. Send me. If you enjoyed the podcast, please consider giving us a 5-star written review. This helps us get our name out there and gives us more visibility. Check out our merchandise, t-shirts, patches on SOCOMathlete.com. If you're training for special operations, we have free group training chats, like-minded individuals all over the country in a region near you. Be sure to check us out on SOCOMathlete.com. Check out our Hell Day events and some of our past podcasts. Give us a follow on Instagram. If you'd like to make a donation, we have a Patreon. Check us out at SOCOMathlete Patreon. Nearly everything we do is volunteer, giving back, and helping those that are training for special operations. And until next time, thanks for tuning in to SOCOM Athletes Podcast. This is your host, Jason. We are out.